Okay, by my reckoning it's 1:30, so what I'm going to do is mute everyone now. So apart from the speakers, your phone will be muted and you won't be able to join in the conversations. And we'll start the presentation. If you have the first slide, which says Voices of the Infection Prevention Society 2011, I'd just like to welcome everyone to this year's Voices of the IPS teleclass. My name's Maria Benalik, and I'll be hosting the teleclass, but unfortunately for you, I'll also be presenting quite a chunk of the teleclass today as well. You're going to hear several IPS voices over the next 45 or 50 minutes or so, which we hope will give you a real picture of the main developments in the society. If you turn to the next slide, first of all, we're going to have an introduction by the president of the Infection Prevention Society. Then I'm going to pass over to the chair of the Scientific Program Committee, who's responsible for the content of our annual conference. Then we're going to be looking at the development of one of our major projects in the IPS, which is the competency framework. We're going to look at the structure of the competences, the use of the competences, and then at the end, we're going to have a couple of interviews with practitioners who are aware of the competences and are either using them or are planning to use them in the very near future. So hopefully you'll get some ideas for your own practice about how they can be used. So firstly, I'd like to introduce our current president, Tracy Cooper, and she's going to set the scene for us for the rest of the presentation. Thank you, Tracy. Over to you.
Thank you, Maria. If I can get people to move to the next slide. First of all, a huge thank you to Paul Weber at Weber Training for facilitating this Voices teleclass again this year. I hope it will allow us to share with you just a snapshot of the work that's going on behalf of members and, of course, our patients, residents and service users in terms of improving infection prevention across all of the five countries of the UK and Ireland. So there is a phenomenal amount of work and a huge debt of gratitude to our board members, our consultative committee members, and many people at branch level who do a great deal of work to ensure the society continues to flourish and grow. We've got involvement in national work programmes and many consultations across all of the countries. I think one of the very exciting things about the society, which some people are not aware of, is that our branches in Scotland, in Wales, in Northern Ireland and Ireland link directly with the various governments and devolved administrations in those countries and have a great deal of input to the programme in the same way that the IPS links nationally in England to the department and participates in a range of consultations. So there is a huge amount, and I would encourage all of our members, when we send things out and ask for your comments and your input, please do send them back, because it does make a difference when we get your contributions back to the feedback we're able to give nationally. And some of that feedback is really listened to and valued, which is great. We've also had, just to give you a snapshot, we've had the completion of the Surgical Site Infection Roadshow. We had our national conference in Bournemouth last year, and our very successful first run, walk or crawl for IFIC that raised money that IFIC will use to support those in less well-established countries to actually develop their infection prevention knowledge. And we've got branch conferences that continue to thrive. I was recently at the Joint London Branches Conference, and the quality of the academic programme was superb. I'm aiming to be at other branch conferences throughout the year and next year, and I think they offer a wealth of material for us all to develop. And then there are the bigger pieces of work that are going on perhaps in the background, the dental audit tool, and we have members who are still working to bring those to final completion and mail out to all of the dental practices in England. And we've recently had an approach from Wales, and the Chief Dental Officer in Wales is interested in taking the audit tool as well, which again is fantastic. The quality improvement tool, as you'll know from the recent bulletin, Those are now with our country leads, waiting for them to sign off and confirm the tool does meet the spec and what we agreed we would do. And we really do hope to have those with you shortly. Apologise for the delay with those. And then we have the competencies, and you'll hear much more about that later. If I can move you on to the next slide. In terms of where we're going next and moving forward, our strategy, which you will have seen information about, is almost final. We have a few more bits and pieces to do on that, and then it will be there, and we aim to launch that at our conference in Bournemouth this year. And it will be the absolute blueprint to guide future work. It's a fantastic piece of work, and a great deal of thanks to Julie Storr, our Vice President, for her leadership of that work. Our journal continues to develop and grow. You will know that it's indexed on several nursing indices at the moment, and we continue work and development, aiming ultimately to get Medline indexing on the journal. The R&D program, Yvonne Curran is now leading the R&D group and is currently reviewing and refocusing the R&D program to be in line with the strategy, but also to really support members in their workplace and getting actively involved in research in particular. And I think that will be really valuable for all of us out there in frontline practice. And then we've got the various educational outputs that continue to support specialist and generalist staff, including the newly published outcome competencies. So I'm delighted at this point to hand over to Debbie and hand over the rest of the teleclass. I would urge every member that's listening to really try and get involved in the work of the IPS in the next year, even if it's just responding on consultations and attending some of the branch education that's out there. We do continue to grow and we continue to work to serve the needs of our members. So I will now hand over to Debbie. Thank you.
Thank you, Tracy. Next, I'd like to invite Debbie. I think there's some really exciting initiatives for all of us there. And I think we to kind of move on from this, we'll ask Debbie, who leads the Scientific Programme Committee, to say a few words about this year's conference. Over to you, Debbie.
Thank you, Maria. Just onto the slide, Infection Prevention 2011. Infection Prevention 2011 is being held for the second year in the seaside town of Bournemouth, England, from the 19th to the 21st of September in 2011. The overarching theme this year is Stronger Together, and how we can do this by informing expert practice, promoting partnership and collaboration, and sustaining systems for patient safety. Just moving on to the next slide in terms of the results and feedback from the Society's annual conference, this continues to be a very positive year on year. The conference was attended by the largest number of people to date, and the number of abstracts received for oral and posters continues to grow, and we received over 90 abstracts last year. The speaker evaluations identified that over 90% of speakers were either good or excellent, which really indicates the high quality and standard of the scientific programme. Once again, the conference was very well supported by our corporate colleagues, and the conference hosted the largest UK infection prevention exhibition. Going on to topics for 2011, the topics are relevant and will entice colleagues working in infection prevention from a variety of settings, which includes acute, community, mental health and commissioning. And Anne Bialowski, the immediate past president of CHICA, will be presenting the annual Cottrell Lecture on the theme Stronger Together. And Sir Liam Donaldson will be presenting the ALIF Lecture on the global issues facing patient safety and infection prevention. There are many more topics being presented by lots of national and international speakers, and the full programme is now available on the IPS website, and I certainly would encourage you all to go and have a look there and look at the quality and the standard and the objectives of all the sessions. I think you'd find them very, very useful wherever you work. Looking at how, onto the next slide, in terms of professional development, as well as the excellent scientific programme, the National Conference supports delegates' professional development by offering the opportunity to share local improvements in practice. And this can be done by the submission of an abstract for either an oral or a poster presentation. Information on how to do this is on the IPS website, and you will also find a recording of a teleclass which was presented by Heather Loveday, which may help you to either start and to plan or to develop your abstract. CME points have also been applied for through the Royal College of Pathologists, and we are confident that due to the excellent programme, we will again be awarded at least 16 points. A new feature to the conference this year is in relation to the IPS competencies. All of the conference sessions will be actually mapped to the competencies, and this will enable delegates to identify sessions which will be useful for their own professional development. The certificate of attendance will also detail the actual sessions and also the competencies this relates to, and this will provide, I feel, vital evidence for the delegate. There is much more information regarding Infection Prevention 2011 on the IPS website, including travel and accommodation details and registration, and also information on the social events, which, as Tracy alluded to, includes the 5K run, walk or crawl for IFIC, the Monday social event, and the Society's Gala Dinner. I do hope many of you will be able to attend conference this year, and if you do, I certainly look forward to seeing you there. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Debbie. And if you now turn to the next slide, it's over to me. As I said, my name is Maria Benalik, and I'm a member of the Education and Professional Development Committee of the Infection Prevention Society, and we've been working for what seems forever on the production of the competency framework that really is designed to inform practitioners working in today's healthcare environment. Next slide. The current situation is that we're all working in this high-profile profession. Infection prevention and control has never been higher on our agenda for patient safety and for quality improvement. We're in a rapidly changing healthcare environment. We know that only last week it was announced that the white paper changes are going to be on hold. There are many changes planned in the UK, and we really don't know what the final NHS is going to look like in the next few years. And that obviously is going to impact on all kinds of practitioners. The quality improvement and patient safety culture will never end and certainly should never end. We must always keep on improving and making things safer and better for our patients. There is certainly increased public awareness around infections and infection prevention, and that continues to rise. Years ago, if we'd had a conversation with a member of the general public and we talked about MRSA or Clostridium difficile, they really wouldn't have had a clue what we were talking about. Everybody is much more aware, much more savvy, if you like, around the organisms and the implications for clinical practice. The media attention has certainly contributed to that. There's many headlines relating to flesh-eating killer bugs and various other dreadful things. And many people are terrified of going into healthcare situations because of what they've read in the media. We're developing a zero tolerance to healthcare-associated infections and following the USA in this regard. But also our teams are changing. The structure of our teams are changing in response to financial and other pressures. So there really is a high priority for improving quality, and healthcare-associated infections are one of the markers that are used to assess the quality of care delivered to our patients. So we need to be fully aware of that. On the next slide, what we hope that the competences will do is facilitate and guide the development of infection prevention and control practitioners so that they become experienced rainmakers who can then contribute significantly to improving patient care. So do we have a skills shortage in the country? Well, let's hope that our competence framework will reduce that. Next slide. There are huge challenges in today's healthcare environment. Certainly there are increasing admissions. We know that there is an aging population. And I chose that little graphic at the bottom corner of the slide because I thought that was quite a nice one. I'm looking forward to the aging process in a way, and I want mine to be as happy as that looks. We have reduced length of patient stay and increasing pressures to reduce it further. we can do more things. We can do more invasive clinical procedures, so we do them. We have increased surveillance, more screening. We need to gather information and we give feedback on performance. I don't need to mention, I don't think, the scarce resources that there are in the NHS, and we also know that they're going to get scarcer. The priorities are forever competing. Mentioning the white paper again, we really don't know where we're going with that now, because so much of the UK's NHS development is now on hold. So there are huge challenges in today's healthcare environment. In addition to all the clinical challenges, there are constant, and some would say unrealistic, financial targets and pressures on the NHS in the UK. The Health Secretary, Andrew Lansley, has announced a break in the change process for the moment, but there's no doubt that there are major changes ahead in the NHS, and infection prevention and control practitioners will be affected along with everyone else. Next slide. Just a little bit of background onto the competency development. And here I'd like to mention a very dear friend and colleague of mine, Debbie King, who I'm sure we all know, who led the first competency development for the ICNA, as it was then, right back in 2001. And in many ways, it just seems like yesterday. Those competencies were then reviewed in 2004. And they were the starting point for the EPDC to look at the new competence framework that you're all becoming familiar with. So we use those documents, along with the 2008 Improving Patient Safety in Europe document, and we use those as a starting point to develop the framework for our Blue Sky Thinking Day in 2008. We had that in Birmingham. It was organised and run by the EPDC members, and it produced an awful lot of data relating to members' ideas of what should be in the new competence document. We've had many, many drafts. We're all a little bit greyer, a little bit more tired since we started this process, and many of the drafts were produced. Some were circulated for comment around the membership, and the final document really looks very different to the first one, the first draft that we sent out. And that's really thanks to all of you who contributed to those feedbacks for us. It was a really invaluable exercise and wonderful data that was given to us to enable us to develop the final document. So thank you for that. On the next page, the next slide, I would just like to acknowledge and to thank the Competency Steering Group. And as you can see from that group, there are international representatives on there. This group informed the way that the competencies were developed and worked very closely with the key members of the EPDC, and those are Emma Burnett and Rosilla Horton were our representatives, as well, along with Margaret Tannehill, who then fed back to the group and kept us on the straight and narrow. So thank you, everybody in the steering group. Next slide, addressing the challenges. Highly visible infection prevention and control teams. We need to be out there. We need to be seen. We need to be ready to prepare and to give expert advice and support. We need to be much more proactive than reactive, using data to drive improvement and to have a clear direction and a plan in the direction we're going. We certainly also need to link to research. These were the main drivers which the steering group guided us to consider as foundations for the competences that we developed. But ultimately, we need competent infection prevention control practitioners who will lead and develop excellent clinical practice for the long-term and the short-term benefit of our patients. Next slide. There's some more considerations that we had to include, And this has come from the work done by Tracy Cooper. And we tried to include this in the way we designed the competency framework. We know that there isn't going to be a one-size-fits-all document. And the idea behind the way we've developed the competency framework is that you can pick a mix, and we'll talk to practitioners later on and interview them and listen to see how they use them for their staff. We needed to make sure that the document was applicable to all nations and it linked to the knowledge and skills framework, personal development plans, but also we were aware that not everybody who works in infection prevention and control actually work in the NHS. So we needed to include NHS as well as non-NHS considerations. We are increasingly becoming a multi-professional workforce working in the field of infection prevention and control. We are no longer just nurses, and we had to take that into account as well as looking at the competencies that were already out there. We needed to try and build in some of the softer skills, some of the more difficult things to measure, as well as including specialist knowledge and skills, making it a workable and user-friendly document. So not a particularly big ask. You know, we could knock that up in an afternoon, I don't think. We needed to build all these aspects at the same time as keeping the document short, snappy, and user-friendly. So it was quite a challenge. On the next slide, I thought it would be useful to just have one or two definitions for us so that we know what we're talking about when we talk about competence and competency. So the competence, the definition of the competence is given there, the skills and ability to practice safely and effectively without the need for being supervised directly. And competency, a person orientated in reference to underlying characteristics and qualities that are indicative of effective performance of the job. So we were building a framework that could be used to guide the development of competence, i.e. the skills and ability of practitioners out there in clinical practice. Next slide. We needed also to make sure that our framework linked to others. So we needed to be aware of the knowledge and skills framework within the NHS. We needed to be aware of the domains of the Advanced Practitioner Toolkit in the Modernising Nursing Careers document. And that's the Career and Development Framework for Nursing. The Skills for Health, National Occupational Health Standard, National Occupational Standards, and the Department of Health Advanced Level Nursing, as well as the NHS Leadership Qualities Framework. So we tried to build all these in and linking in what we recognised and what the feedback told us was important for an infection prevention practitioner and how this linked into all these other drivers for nursing and other professions within the NHS. So on the next slide, we actually start to look at the competences themselves. The competences are presented in four domains, and I'm sure all of us can identify each of these domains in the context of considering infection prevention and control practice. So we have six competences that are directly linked to the nitty-gritty of clinical practice, four that relate specifically to education, three related to research, and four relating to leadership and management. And those 17 competencies in total, we feel, are a good starting point for developing competence for any infection prevention control practitioner. On the next slide, I just thought it might be interesting to think about one or two thoughts around leadership and research. Hope you've never sat in a meeting like this. I know I have. On the next slide, I was just rubbing sticks together for fun. I didn't realise I was doing basic research. I put this in because I think maybe we don't always realise how innovative we are. I just want to mention here that we do have, as Tracy said at the beginning, we have a research strategy part of our IPS strategy, and we're hoping that we're going to be working really closely with the Education Professional Development Committee and the research and development team so that we can develop our research, our education strategy and our research strategy together and link them very closely. Next slide. The use of the competences. Who are they for? How can they be used? We see the competences being used by a range of individuals, by organisations that are looking for expertise to drive forward infection prevention, managers of health and social care services, education providers so that they can ensure that education and training provision meets service needs and promotes quality and safety. Obviously, for practitioners out there, those who are working at or very near the advanced level of practice, as well as those who contribute to infection prevention and control, but also have an interest in further professional development within the field. So you may not need to use every competence for every practitioner, but there will be some that you can use depending on where your practitioner is or where you are in your development. On the next slide, we looked at designing the competences to be a multi-professional and a multi-purpose tool that can support and inform strategic planning, workforce development, and management at strategic and unit level. They'll also provide guidance for educational commissioning and structure the content of education and training programs, whether these are developed internally by employing organizations or universities. The competences will also enhance local accountability and support the role and development of current and aspiring infection prevention and control practitioners. So, for example, when we're looking at the service and strategic level, we can look at service reviews, workforce design and profiling, education commissioning. They can be used for that. At units and managerial level, they can be used in the process of recruitment and selection, in staff appraisal, education, training and development, career development, designing professional and vocational qualifications, but then also right down to the individual and team level, where we can look at career progression and self-assessment and personal development planning and clinical supervision. So we see them as being a really useful tool for all aspects of professional development in that regard. On the next slide, we never stop evolving, and I suspect that the competences will also need to evolve, and I just quite like that cartoon, so I put that in. The next slide shows us a bit of a graph that we can all relate to, and to me it shows a typical picture of how we might move to becoming a fully competent practitioner. We have our level of competence on the perpendicular axis and time along the bottom. And I think we can all recognise those aspects of development, the denial, the frustration, but also the development and the application leading to completion and moving up that competency ladder. On the next slide, we have an illustration, a different type of illustration, called the Stairway to Competence. Now, without wishing to sound like Donald Rumsfeld when he talked about known unknowns, etc., these are recognised steps to becoming competent and to becoming masters in our trade. So we start with this unconscious incompetence. We don't really know what we don't know. We then start to realise what we don't know. We start to put that right. We become learning aware. We act on that. We develop further. And ultimately, we become unconsciously competent. We can just do it. We can become masters in our trade. And we see our competence framework as being a tool to facilitate individuals' development up that stairway. On to the next slide. And we're now going to go down to a little bit of nitty-gritty. I'm not going to go into great detail, but I just thought it would be useful for us to look at the structure of the competence, a competence statement, and we'll pick one of them to look at in a little bit more detail. So what do they look like? We have a competence statement, and that's a broad expectation of what needs to be done or where we're aiming for with that particular competence. The performance indicator is aligned to each of those statements. So for each of the competences, we have a number of performance indicators. How do we know we've got there? The generic and specific knowledge is what you need to enable you to achieve those performance indicators, and by achieving the performance indicators, you can then become competent in that particular area. So, for example, the generic knowledge, understanding and skills can be things around including risk assessment, balance broader organizational needs with infection prevention and control requirements, communication skills, negotiating skills, leadership skills. And lastly, the competence individually, each of the competences are aligned to national occupational standards, the knowledge and service framework, and the skills for health. On the next slide, we have one of the competences there written out for you. But we're going to flick over straight away, or virtually straight away, onto the next one, because I've broken it down so that we can look at one in a little bit more detail. And I've just chosen one of the competence statements around the domain, which is clinical practice. And if you remember, we have those four domains. This is one of the clinical practice ones. And it simply says, advise on the design, construction, modification of facilities to prevent and control infection in the built environment. On the next slide, I've just taken one of the performance indicators so that you can see how that's broken down and how it relates to the competence statement. And one of those is to advise on the infection prevention and control risk assessment criteria prior to a new build and in advance of any demolition or modification of a building consistent with current building guidance and legislation. So by reaching that performance indicator, achieving that performance indicator along with all the others, you can then demonstrate that you've met that competence statement in that domain. Leading on to the next slide, the knowledge, understanding and skills that you need to meet your performance indicator is written here, an example of the knowledge required to meet the performance indicators. Legislation, guidance and outcome indicators relating to the design, construction and modification of the built environment, ventilation, water sources, etc. So I hope you can see how these three aspects, these three layers build up your competency statement, and then on the next slide you can see that each of these relate to aspects of the knowledge and skills framework and national occupational standards. That's just one example for you for us to discuss and see, so that you can see how they all relate together. On the next slide, we have the key benefits of competency using a written competency document. People with clear written goals accomplish far more in a shorter period of time than people without them could ever imagine. So the framework will encourage the identification of learning needs by practitioners. These can then be related to development activities and actions built into SMART objectives for practitioners. So these SMART objectives, which are specific, measurable, achievable, realistic and timed, can be documented. They can be used as a self-assessment, and they can also be used by line managers and others to guide practitioners in their development in reaching full competence. Finally, for my section, I've finished with an image that to me demonstrates competency, and that's riding a bike. Because at the end of the day, we want these competences to be a tool which can be used to help practitioners become competent in their roles. So a simple analogy would be learning to ride a bike. It's tricky to start with. We may need stabilizers, but once we've got it, we can really, really move forward at speed. Who knows? We might even win a gold medal or two at the Infection Prevention Olympics. On that thought, I'd like now to lead on to the next session of the Voices presentation. Two very brave practitioners have volunteered to be interviewed live, online, over the telephone, to give us some idea of the practicalities of the use of the competencies out there in clinical practice. So first of all, I'd like to invite Julie Hughes to come online. Julie, are you there?
I am, yes.
Lovely. Welcome. I'm going to ask Julie a number of questions, and we're going to let you listen into our conversation, and hopefully you'll pick up some tips and some ideas from our discussion. So first of all, Julie, can I ask you to give us your position in your organisation? Tell us a little bit about yourself.
Okay, I'm a nurse consultant in mental health. I work 4 days a week in practice, and I'm a senior lecturer at the university 1 day a week.
And how long have you been in infection control?
Nearly 20 years this year.
Oh gosh, a mere beginner.
A long time.
Can you tell us if you've used the new competency document and how you've used it?
Okay, I used the draft competencies to practice, and now I've just started them. I've used them with infection control secondment post. I've just had a new infection control nurse starting with me 2-3 weeks ago, and I've just started using it with her. And this morning, I tried using it with our team secretary, infection control team secretary, which was actually quite useful because I hadn't thought of using it in that area, but I'll come back to that. In relation to the secondment, I'm glad you said that you pick and mix, because I felt that's what I was doing. I selected some of the competencies to try out, and one of the areas I looked at was clinical practice in relation to managing incidents and outbreaks. We had a person in post on a secondment for about 18 months, and during that time, probably like all of you, we had quite a few norovirus outbreaks, and it was useful to develop her skills, and she actually used it as a self-assessment tool as well. And one of the things she commented on that I hadn't thought of, she actually found it a good checklist, you know, what to do in the event of an outbreak following the sessions, so the example of the performance indicators. So she actually found that helpful. In relation to the new ICN, well, she's new to us, but she's actually been qualified for 2 years. We've been looking at developing her in relation to research and leadership, and working through those actual areas has been able us to decide on what courses she needs, you know, she would like to do in the future. So she's starting a leadership module on a master's program. And this only this morning, we've just started using it with our team secretary, who's developing her skills around audit and data collection and analysis. So some of the issues in relation to that, which I can't find it in front of me at the moment, which element it was. All right, clinical practice on two, you know, the area on collate, analyse and communicate data. So that was quite useful for being able to look at her development and what she'd like to do. For example, something as simple as doing more another course on Excel to help us with the data, etc.
Right, so that was quite a surprise, really, to find that you could use it, found it a useful document even to use with the secretary. It's clearly not clinical.
Yeah. Yeah, because she'd like to develop her skills in the future. And I was just reading through some of the competencies this morning, and I thought, oh, this actually fits in with, you know, with our team secretary's approach as well. I've also used it for an assistant practitioner who came to us with on a secondment as well, but that was in the draft form. And again, some of those were the pick and mix areas around that. And I've used a section on, you know, the advice and design number 5 for clinical practice, advice on the design, construction and modification of facilities for the seconded post. And she found that really useful in developing her skills on helping out in the built environment.
Oh, that's lovely, Julie. Thanks ever so much. Can you tell us of any pros and cons that you've had in using the document?
To be honest, initially I felt it difficult to get my head around at first because I was so much more familiar with the old documents. But it was only a matter of getting used to it. The pros, I'd say, is a really useful development tool for all staff. Certainly for myself, I'm using it to look at my own development and self-assessment. But I also, I've been working on trying to map some of those competencies against the other standards, you know, the KSS and the National Occupational Standards. And I like the way that all the work's done for me on this, you know, in this area. And also, one of the pros of it as well, we're running a master's module around infection prevention and control at the university where I work, and I'm planning to go through the competencies and map that across as well, so that the courses are much more mapped out for our practitioners.
So do you envisage any other, you've got a whole load of things that you've used it for there, but do you envisage any other uses it could have in the future?
Again, to look at, I'd like to look at it with our infection control link practitioners. Certainly, I don't know if there's any of the mental health practitioners there, but at one time we found it difficult to get infection prevention and control practitioners to work in mental health, although that's changing. And one of the things I like about these competencies, we can almost, grow our own, if you like, by looking at the competencies and see how we can match them, because we've got some excellent infection control link practitioners out there that I'd like to use some of this to develop their role and also give them the opportunities if any posts or comments come up that they're actually, you know, have got the experience to apply for such role.
That's lovely. Thank you very much for that, Julie. So can I now turn to Colin? This is Colin Clark. Colin, can I just ask you to introduce yourselves to the people listening in and tell us a little bit about your position in your organisation and how long you've been in infection control, etc.
Okay, yes. My name is Colin Clark. I'm a lead nurse and head of service for infection prevention and control in the Southern Trust in Northern Ireland, one of 5 trusts. We have acute, non-acute and community responsibility. I manage a team of 9 nurses presently and recruiting hopefully one more. I've been in infection control for about 16 years and I am by no means an expert in competencies, but I'm happy to talk. So that's about it.
No, that's great. I know that you've looked at the new competencies, and I'd also like to mention that Colin is one of our new members of the EPDC, so this is a baptism of fire for you, Colin, really. But I know you've looked at them and you envisage using them with a new member of staff. Is that right?
Yes, that is right, Maria. And I mean, I suppose, and I have already used them since our last discussion, I suppose, for the purposes, one of which Julie didn't mention, is recruitment and selection. I used it very recently in the interview situation where I was providing an opportunity really for a band 6 to upgrade to a band 7 within my present team. And I found them exceptionally useful for that purpose. But I do plan to use them. I've had a new nurse who started on a secondment for 6 months, and I plan to use them. In fact, we've just had discussion engagement this morning in an effort to introduce her to the competencies and give her a chance to get her head around it. Because I'm still, I suppose, initially, I'm very excited about the opportunity for the framework to be there. But there is an awful lot of content, and it can be quite scary initially when you sort of cast your eye over it.
So do you think that could be a bit of a con? If we're looking at pros and cons, Do you think that might be people find it a little bit overwhelming, or are you getting used to the pick and mix idea?
No, I think, the words that I have here to describe it are pretty similar to pick and mix. I have mix and match, which is probably very similar in the Irish way to put it, and to me that makes a lot of sense. That is an interesting concept, and one that I find particularly exciting about the competency framework. I suppose, yes, pros and cons. I think we need time to become familiar with it. We need time to consider its application. We need time to feel comfortable with the framework. We need time to, but having said that, the availability and the provision of the framework after such a lot of hard work, I have to say, is very welcomed. And I think, like you describe it, riding a bike, we'll get there. I think it has an awful lot to offer.
Have you given any more thought to specific things that you could use it for in the future?
I mean, I suppose, again, Julie had mentioned, I thought she wasn't going to mention it and I would be innovative here, but my link system, I have just, we're launching in our Southern Trust here, and we're launching a new approach to our link system, and it's a masterclass approach. And like Julie, I can identify with some individuals who I feel would benefit immensely from perhaps, adopting the competency framework in an effort to let them see, I suppose, how much they can offer and continue to offer. So my plan really is probably at one of our master classes to concentrate on the competencies and implement those with those who are willing to engage with me in regard to that. And obviously I plan to use them with my existing staff for the purposes of personal development reviewing and personal development planning. There is, in your map of competency, I think we're probably at the acceptance stage now, and
right.
We hopefully will continue into the other stages that you describe in that graph,
Right, well, thank you very much, Colin, and thank you very much, Julie. And I just think, in summary, having listened to, and I wasn't aware of what either of my colleagues were going to say, but immediately what I see we're getting from people who are out there in practice using the document and the framework is that it really is an adaptable tool. We heard about it being used for recruitment and selection over in Belfast. We're looking at how it's being used or being planned to be used for infection control practitioners. The concept of the pick and mix is turning out to be quite a practical one. And so I think really I'm hoping that we'll all kind of get on board the bike really and start using this and taking things forward. So I would just like to thank all of you for listening in today. Thank you all the speakers. Tracy, if you're still with us, thank you. Debbie, I know, isn't available anymore. Thank you again to Julie and Colin. If any of you do have any questions that you'd like to raise around the competencies, please feel free to email on the address that's at the bottom of the slide of iWeber Training, or you can get any of the EPDC details, members' details, on the IPS website. So thank you all, one and all, for listening in. Really hope that you enjoy using the competencies, and hopefully we'll see some of you, if not all of you, at conference in Bournemouth. Thank you very much, and goodbye.